Ash Wednesday is one of the more interesting holy days in the Christian liturgical year. It kicks off the season of Lent, a time when Christians for the last 1,600 years or so prepare themselves to commemorate the death and celebrate the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. The day has historically been marked by prayer and fasting and a ritual called the imposition of the ashes. If you haven't been to a service on Ash Wednesday, you probably have still seen someone on a Wednesday in late February or March at a grocery store maybe, or at work, that has ashes on their forehead. And that's from this service. At the service, black smudges of ash are smeared on people's foreheads, and the person who's running the show says something like, "Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return." The ritual calls to mind our mortality and the limitations we have as human beings, and appeals to us to make good choices, to live lives that are honest and just and loving. In a culture that avoids the mention of our own mortality and to varying degree outsources life's final moments, I think the imposition of the ashes can feel rather alien, supremely uncomfortable, and a little too religious for most. Recently, however, this could be changing. The Death Awareness Movement is a loose network of individuals, groups, and organizations around the world that have been working to make the topic of death less taboo. Its predecessor was spawned the modern hospice movement in the latter part of the 20th century, and today, people can take classes in their communities or over the internet that demystify our mortality and provide honest information, support, and training for end-of-life issues. One of the questions that come out of this movement, and one that has come out of the ritual of the imposition of the ashes for centuries, is important for us today. How would the choices we make, both big life choices and small everyday ones, be affected if we carried with us a greater awareness of our own mortality? In fact, a coffee shop in Bangkok, Thailand is testing this out. The coffee shop is actually called the Death Awareness Cafe. And it encourages its customers to experience death awareness and reflect on their lives by inviting their patrons to get inside a coffin and spend some time with the lid closed after they finish their coffee. The owner of the cafe told the United Press International in June that the practice encourages people not to be driven by greed. When the lid of the coffin closes, they will realize that eventually they cannot take anything with them. Oh, this was interesting. I think something like this is happening in Jesus' encounter with a man who calls on him to arbitrate between he and his brother about the family fortune. A crowd has gathered at the beginning of Luke chapter 12, and Jesus begins to instruct his disciples, but the chapter feels a little unruly. The crowd is so large that people are starting to be stepped on. And as Jesus is teaching this kind of close group of disciples, it sounds like there are people yelling out from the crowd and asking Jesus questions. In verse 13, a man calls to Jesus and asks him to play the role of an arbiter between he and his brother regarding the family inheritance. Inheritance practices provided the firstborn child of the family with a real leg up. It would have been customary for the firstborn male heir to receive 50% or more of the land, wealth, and material possessions his parents had when they passed away. The remaining percentage was divided among the rest of the children and was based on gender, birth order, vocation, temperament, and many other criteria. Scholars assume that the man who has come to Jesus is not the firstborn male heir. And the family and is asking Jesus to make his older brother give him a larger portion of the inheritance. There is evidence that this is actually a pretty common practice at the time to have religious leaders arbitrate cases like these. And sometimes the firstborn male son was considered a ne'er-do-well or someone who couldn't carry on the family name. And these cases would have been awarded to family members. But Jesus isn't interested in playing this arbiter role. Instead, he makes this moment a teaching moment about the follies of greed. The parable of the rich fool is not one of Jesus' greatest hits, like the parable of the prodigal son or the mustard seed or the rich man and Lazarus, but it gives us insight in how Jesus, particularly the Gospel of Luke's portrayal of Jesus, thought about wealth, money, poverty, and the like. The land of a rich man produced abundantly, Jesus starts. And the rich man thought to himself, "What should I do? For I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.'" Notice that the only character in this story is the rich man. In fact, he doesn't even have a dialogue partner, so he just talks to himself this whole time, which might say something about who he is. In fact, the word "I" or "my" is mentioned 12 times in this very short parable. "What shall I do? My crops, my barn, my grain, my goods, my soul." Now, God then speaks to the rich man, and I think of this as a type of death premonition or a dream or something like a scene from the Christmas Carol, where the rich man is played by Ebenezer Scrooge, and the ghost of Christmas past, present, and yet to come is played by God. Here God says, "This very night your life will be demanded of you. You will die. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" Here, I think Jesus reminds this man and the entire crowd that is gathered around him of their mortality through this short parable, much like the imposition of the ashes or doing something creepy like crawling into a casket for a little while. All that we accumulate over the life we have cannot go with us. The lives we have now are not built on those things that we have accumulated. What we see in the parable is a man who is driven by the accumulation of things to the point that no one else matters and there are no other characters in the story. The field produced a good harvest, planting done by his workers or slaves, most likely in this context, and nourished by the rain and the sun, not under the control of this rich man. The harvest is not shared. For the rich man, the abundance is not shared among the workers, nor a portion of it is offered in gratitude to the community that he relies on, or God, who provides all things. For the rich man sees the abundant harvest as the work of his own labor, as if he's entitled to all of it as he wishes. I think acknowledging our limitations in the socioeconomic systems we are a part of is a difficult thing to do in America. the money we make, the houses we live in, the experiences we pay for, the stuff we accumulate as a result of our hard work. And we have stories to prove it. Those times when we worked two or three jobs at one time, when we toiled all night to finish a project or stayed up for months on end for a second job, or when we put ourselves through school, when we lived frugally for a year so that we could afford that really big thing that was important to us. It's part of the American psyche to aim for self-sufficiency and self-determination. I don't think that we have a lot of space for our limitations in this outlook. The limitations of our lives are the ways in which there is so much out of our control, both good and bad, that conspire to make for a good life. Healthy upbringings that are a result of chance and good choices of others, the mental acuity to make sense of a complex world, and the overall health to make sense of this complex world for a long period of time. The social capital we carry to be well-educated, to have education paid for, in most cases, by the state or by our families. To receive countless breaks and more opportunity because of where we were born and raised and where we live. To know that the efficient working of the land taken by its original inhabitants, by our ancestors, and often exploited to the point of ruin, is the ultimate base of the strength of our economy. That this work that allows all others to work is 10% perspiration and 90% precipitation. That each of our jobs or previous vocations or current retirement plans are the result of the hard work of ourselves, but also of many, many others, and countless variables which are out of our control. You know, it makes me wonder how the parable would have gone if the rich man had acknowledged these limitations, that by the grace of God, as he would have put it, the year was good. That because he could not claim the harvest as his own, others shared in the abundant year. Everyone that had a hand in the harvest ate a little bit better. Everyone had a little more free time. Everyone received a bump in pay. And as much as we would want to believe, as hard as we've worked, or despite all those times we've pulled ourselves up by our own bootstraps, or come to realize through stories like these that none of us are self-made. All of us are here by the grace of God, limited as we are and still cherished just the same. Likewise, all we have is by the grace of God. It can leave in an instant. And if that would change us, we should ask ourselves if it would change us for the better or for the worse. May God make us less worried about material things. May God make us less greedy people. May we acknowledge our limitations and still not be worried. For we are not defined by them, but by our God, the author and provider of our whole lives. Amen.